This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
President Obama took to the Rose Garden today to talk about the economy. There was some kind of technical glitch, though, so at one point, he actually had to stop and say, "Hey, is this thing on?" He was talking, of course, about the microphone. Could well have been the economy, though. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 30th of August. Good to have you here. It was supposed to be an economic pep talk the president was giving this morning about how 2 years ago when Lehman Brothers went under, things were bad, but how they're getting better now. Had a little hiccup, though.
What we did know was that it took nearly a decade. How are we doing on sound, guys? Is it still going in the press? Okay. What we did know was that it was going to take nearly a decade.
And with that, he was back on track. But the symbolism wasn't lost at all. Despite the best efforts of the White House and the Fed, the general economic vibe out there is that things could be better. Over in the other economy, though, the one where companies and corporations live, business is booming. This month alone, the money that has changed hands in mergers and acquisitions has hit almost $250 billion. Just today, we learned the French drug maker Sanofi Aventis wants to buy American biotech company Genzyme for almost $20 billion. But if it's true that the economy could get worse again before it gets better, and just to be clear here, that is still an if, but if it is a possibility, then how come businesses are spending all this money? Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
The reason behind all this corporate dealing is nothing new, really. Many companies were ruthless in cutting costs and hoarding their cash out of fear after the financial collapse. And they're now sitting on record reserves. By one estimate, the world's top 1,000 companies are holding around $2 trillion in cash. The result is something Dean Martin sang about years ago.
Money burns a hole in my pocket.
Hedge fund manager Steve Goebbels says the boss is feeling pressure.
Investors have, for the most part, given their CEOs an ultimatum, either dividend the cash back to me or go out there and spend and do something creative with it. Don't just leave it on the balance sheet earning nothing.
Goebbels bets on M&A deals at Chicago Capital Management. He says the weak economy has added to the pressure. It's tough for companies to grow on their own, so CEOs can either buy new technology to stay a step ahead or essentially try buying new customers. Bob Teitelman watches mergers and acquisitions as editor-in-chief at The Deal.
organic growth is difficult to get, particularly when companies get larger. New product lines need to be developed, and it's often much easier and cheaper to buy rather than develop it internally.
In a lot of cases, the weak economy has turned vulnerable firms into attractive bargains, and private investment firms are eager to unload companies they've had a tough time selling in recent years so they can return cash to their clients. Teitelman also says pessimism about the recovery is actually spurring a lot of these deals.
There's an aspect of this of rushing to get out the door before the door shuts. You might as well sell now before there is a double dip.
Teitelman says that open question raises another one, just how long this new wave of deals can last. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Here's an economic indicator from the classifieds for you. If you happen to be in the market for a used car, move over. There's been a jump in sales and also prices. In fact, brace yourself for some sticker shock. Edmunds.com says the average price for a three-year-old car in this country is up 10% over the past year to almost $20,000 for something that's used. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale draws the wider economic lesson.
A year ago, used cars made up 75% of the overall market. This year, it's 80%. Edmunds.com analyst Jessica Caldwell is seeing pent-up demand for all types of used vehicles.
A lot of people have waited, hoping that the economy will get better to purchase, but they still don't want to pay for a new vehicle.
Prices for used gas guzzlers have especially rebounded. Some SUVs, trucks, and luxury sedans are going for 30% higher than they did just a year ago. Caldwell says folks who shed their big vehicles when gas prices were high are having second thoughts.
We're seeing some customers are being a bit remorseful on that and deciding that, you know, this really isn't working with my lifestyle. I need to get back into a truck or an SUV.
At a used car auction in Florence, South Carolina this afternoon, Kenny Hyman was on the lookout for good prospects. He is used car sales manager at King Cadillac, Buick, and Pontiac. He says it's not just lots of demand that's driving prices. There's also less supply.
They're just not out there to buy. Some auctions would have 1,000 cars. I'm having 200 or 300 now.
9 years ago, the average owner held on to a car for 28 months. Now that's more like 44 months. Polk analyst Lonnie Miller says eventually higher prices for used cars will help new car sales.
Because at some point, consumers are going to say, well, if I'm going to pay that much, I'm going to go buy a new car.
But not until they're more confident about their own financial outlook. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Today is the first day of school in a lot of places, and thanks to state budget cuts, some of those kids are coming back to shorter school years, fewer teachers, and no more art or music classes. But there are some exceptions, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from the Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore.
At a Baltimore elementary school, first graders file in uniform. Unlike students at many schools opening around the country, these kids won't face drastic budget cuts.
I don't think I've ever heard a school system say, we have plenty of money, don't send me anymore. But
Bill Reinhardt is with the Maryland State Department of Education. He says the state has made barely any cuts to K-12 education this year. Maryland's economy has held up fairly well during the recession, and state law requires that local districts spend at least as much this school year as they did last year. Reinhardt says that's helped place Maryland's among the top public school systems in the country.
We certainly have great kids, we have great teachers, we have great administrators, but the money helps.
And Maryland is in line for more money, including $250 million from the Obama administration's Race to the Top contest. Maryland isn't the only exception to state budget troubles. Alan Auden teaches education policy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says school budgets have held up in Wyoming and South Dakota, thanks to their thriving oil, gas, and coal businesses. And he says Arkansas is doing well, too.
It's a fairly mixed economy. They have insurance companies, they have Walmart, they have Tyson Chicken.
Arkansas also has a law guaranteeing adequate school funding, but money doesn't guarantee success. Auden says as Wyoming has spent more on education, student performance has flattened or dropped. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Somebody smacked traders across the knuckles with a ruler today. Wall Street was in a lousy mood. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. 5 years after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, nobody is saying the city is back yet. In his speech down there yesterday, the president went so far as to say New Orleans is coming back. And the population is up to about 80% of what it was before the storm. The business of rebuilding has saved the city from the worst of the recession. But the longer-term New Orleans economy, that is still a challenge, as Marketplace's Eve Troe reports.
If you stand in Greg Rigamer's lakefront office, you can see New Orleans getting its act together. You can hear it, too. A construction crew is almost done driving pilings for a new flood wall.
It takes 270 blows to push a pile down in the soil here.
Rigamer likes to count things. He runs an urban planning firm. And he has every figure you'd want to know about New Orleans, like the city is down about 80,000 jobs, or it has more than 50,000 vacant homes. Some things are working in the city. It has basic services. The lights are on. Schools are open.
But things like playgrounds and libraries and even healthcare facilities and the like are really in short supply.
The government has tried to help. Congress approved billions of dollars in federal relief money for the city. Hundreds of millions have yet to be used. But New Orleans needs long-term private investment to rebuild. The feds tried to push that, too. A tax-free bond program was supposed to attract investors. Wall Street didn't bite.
It was hard for New Orleans to get an investor reputation.
Buck Landry is managing director of investment firm Morgan Keegan in New Orleans. He helped put together a big bond deal for a hotel that fell through.
Couldn't get the bond rated, couldn't sell the bonds. Investors didn't want to come here because of the sensationalism that was created by the storm and the aftermath and, you know, drama.
Landry says investors looked at New Orleans and saw too much risk in broken infrastructure, high crime, and the chance the city would flood again. The new levee system should be finished next year. But an investor wouldn't have to go far from the boardroom to hear that many New Orleans residents aren't sure it's enough. Catherine Daigle's home in the Lakeview neighborhood flooded. I asked if she felt her new house there was safe.
It was supposed to be, but we thought we were protected, and we weren't. Of course, you have some reservations.
I don't have any faith in them fixing that levee.
Melba Leggett in the lower Ninth Ward can see the new levee from her house.
I don't understand them not making it higher and the depth deeper.
Businesses that want to be in the region don't have to choose New Orleans. Planning expert Greg Rigamer says the smaller cities around it aren't as risky or as expensive.
Flood insurance, business interruption insurance costs less, and the likelihood of being shut down for a hurricane is minimized. These are challenges that it will be difficult to address.
The city's new mayor is Mitch Landrieu. He's confident New Orleans can overcome. As he rushed to a budget meeting, he said the city has a lot to offer business, especially creative startups.
They look at their ability to make money, but they also look at livability. They also look at culture. They look at art. They look at music. They look at community spirit, community soul. They also look at buying in when it's cheap so that it can get better, right?
New Orleans may have to decide between big business and charm. At that budget meeting, one item that came up was a plan for a new hospital. It would bring hundreds of jobs, but it would flatten blocks of historic homes. The room was torn, progress or history. It was the kind of debate you used to hear in New Orleans before Katrina hit. And that at least shows the city's getting back to its old self, even if it hasn't started to move forward. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Have a look for yourself at how recovery is going in some of New Orleans' most damaged neighborhoods. Eve put together an audio slideshow. We've got it up at our website. It's marketplace.org. You know, you go through something often enough and you get pretty good at it. That is happening now down in New Orleans, where Katrina and the oil spill have combined to give folks a certain know-how in dealing with disasters, how to recover from them, and in some instances, capitalize on them, too. Shirley Laska created a program at the University of New Orleans that helps people do just that. Professor Laska, welcome to the program.
Nice to be speaking with you.
You are developing down there in New Orleans something of an expertise in disaster recovery, aren't you?
Yes, regretfully so. What we've been doing is receiving just an amazing number of young people. And they have come because they want to learn how to assist in a recovery process. They've investigated the various programs in the universities in the city that have been developed to do recovery, and they are registering and becoming graduate students and getting degrees from us. Urban studies, urban planning, sociology, all these various degrees that contain recovery information.
What do they learn, though? How does that work?
They learn how to think about what is necessary in order for a community to be resilient. The resilience is built upon awareness of risk and developing systematic urban planning, land use planning, all the various elements that go into making a resilient community.
And it's a government and private business sort of enterprise here, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You can't have a recovered community unless you have a business sector that is recovered and recovered more resilient. It's not to build back as it was, but to think about what's necessary so that the next time you don't have such a sharp dip in capacity.
And so these students that you have and the young people that are coming to New Orleans, they eventually acquire this academic expertise. They go out and they do recovery things in New Orleans, and they have this marketable skill that then they can take elsewhere.
They can. Of course, we hope they stay for a while.
Fair enough.
But they also will go back. They'll go back home. They'll go to other major cities and other areas where their skills will be desired. And I truly hope that the businesses and government agencies will recognize them as having, I would call it, human infrastructure for risk reduction.
What about this idea of risk, that it makes businesses better companies, really, if they can figure out a way to plan for the risks that are involved in the economy today? I mean, these young people you're talking about are going to go out and do that for them.
They are, because you don't have you don't want to separate the risk concepts. You want to see them as integrated. So you would have, say, for example, in this decade, you had the 9/11, and companies that learned how to respond to the decline in the economy at that time also probably are more resilient today with the recession.
So what is a successful recovery then?
It's a recovery in which you believe that you have addressed some of these large issues. When Katrina struck, we said that the disaster revealed the underpinnings of a community that was challenged. Working class families are challenged for just their basic necessities. It's sort of like a ski resort where the people who are provide the service industry for that ski resort have to commute an hour or two to trailer park someplace outside of the perimeter. We have to have a working class to support the city. And remember where our culture comes from. Our culture comes to a great extent from the working class. And if we don't have them, we don't have our culture.
Shirley Laska, she was the founding director of the Center for Hazards, Assessment, Response, and Technology at the University of New Orleans. Ms. Laska, thanks so much for your time.
Nice speaking with you.
Coming up, divorce, Dodger style.
They have used the Dodgers to back an enormous number of loans, and they're highly leveraged people.
But first, let's do the numbers. Not a whole lot of action, but plenty of damage on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials threw off 140 points, 1.3%, closed at 10,009. The NASDAQ unloaded 33 points, 1.5%, finished at 2119. The S&P 500 took off 15 points, just under 1.5%, ended things at 1,048. Daily trading volume, by the way, lowest level in a year. Financial shares led the march downhill. Wells Fargo clipped off more than 3%. Bank of America shed 2.5%. On the mergers and acquisitions front, where we started, Hewlett-Packard held on to data storage darling 3PAR for yet another day. HP up 1.5% today. 3PAR lost nearly 2%. Genzyme rejected that all-cash offer from Sanofi. Its shares picked up more than 3.3% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 2.53%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index on attitudes towards spending. The Airline Pilots Association International wraps up its annual Air Safety Forum in Washington. And President Obama delivers a national address on Iraq as the United States ends its combat mission in that country. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. A single ticket on the Paris Metro costs €1.70, about $2.15 at today's rate of exchange. Not bad as fares go for a major world-class city, but for some Metro riders in Paris, the actual amount isn't really the point. They don't want to pay at all. It's not about skipping out on the fare itself. It's about whether urban transit ought to cost anything to begin with. From down deep in the Paris Metro, John Lawrenson reports.
At this station, you've got to be pretty fit and pretty daring to climb over the turnstile. The doors have been built really high to stop you. But every so often, a fare dodger does get through, bunched close behind a ticket holder, often asking politely if they may do so. Now, an underground group, no pun intended, of hardened fare dodgers have launched an insurance scheme for people like this and are urging others to group together and do the same. They pay $10 a month into a kitty they can dip into if they get a fine. But even with fines as low as $70, fare dodging doesn't pay, says Olivier Kotz of the company that runs the Paris Metro. He predicts the insurance scheme will fail.
The idea of an insurance pool seems attractive enough, but after the 10,000th or 20,000th fine, I'd be surprised if they managed to keep it in business.
The fare dodgers organizing this insurance scheme are called Resistance to Paid Transport. They have links with a far-left group called the New Anti-Capitalist Party. They hold monthly meetings in Paris. When I went along to a meeting, they told me saving money was not their goal. The fare dodgers wanted to spark a debate among metro riders and in the media about making city transport as free as many other public services. But they refused to be interviewed on tape. Paying customers like Charlotte Weissmann, Jean-Roch Schall and Sandrine Corby were happy to say what they thought of the idea.
Yeah, of course, should be free. That's the kind of thing everybody needs. Should be provided by the state, like education, healthcare.
Yeah, I don't think it's really a good idea. Because
I don't think it's a really good idea. To pay for the metro is a way to make people more responsible for it. If it's free, you'll have a lot of vandalism.
Our taxes are so high here already. 35% to 40% of my income goes to just ERSAF, which covers all the social programs. So for me, one more thing free means more taxes for me.
10 French cities pushed aside these objections and decided to offer free public transit. Cédric Durand, an economist with Paris's Sorbonne University, says they figure their systems are so heavily subsidized already, usually to the tune of 80% of the real cost, they might as well go the whole way. And he says the results have been spectacular.
In Aubagne, for example, they introduced free public transportation 1 year ago, and in 1 year they observed an increase of 74% of use of public transportation.
But whether free transport would have the same effect in Paris is arguable. When those smaller towns made transport free, their public transport consisted only of underutilized bus services. Paris has a subway system stuffed full of the 4.5 million passengers it carries every day. Its scope for expansion is minimal. Paris's subway company says 96% of its passengers buy tickets, generating $2.5 billion of revenue a year, something they don't plan on giving up. In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Major League Baseball came to the Los Angeles County legal system today. The couple that owns the Los Angeles Dodgers started a high-profile Hollywood-style divorce trial this morning. Actually, we don't know who really owns the team, hence the trial. Frank McCourt says his wife, Jamie, signed away her rights to the Dodgers in a post-nuptial agreement a couple of years ago. California being a community property state, though, Jamie McCourt figures half the team and half of its value of something near $800 million belongs to her. Also at issue, because sometimes a billion-dollar baseball club just isn't enough, are who owns which of their seven houses, how many hundreds of thousands of dollars in monthly living allowance is enough, and who gets the private jet. Meanwhile, the Dodgers stink, players are being released, and Carla Hall is spending her mornings inside the courtroom covering the case for the Los Angeles Times. Carla, good to have you with us.
Good to be there.
Let's set aside all the lawyering for a second and the who did what to whom in this case and ask the fundamental baseball question here, if we could, which is, what happens to the Dodgers if this thing just drags out forever?
Either way, no matter who wins, things could really change for the Dodgers. If he wins, he will be the sole owner of the Dodgers. However, he may be in a position to owe her an enormous amount of money that might make him vulnerable to having to sell the Dodgers. On the other hand, if the judge decides that the Dodgers are community property and they both own the Dodgers, that means either they're both going to have to sell or they're both going to have to get investors to help either one of them buy out the other.
Fair to say the tone is acrimonious?
Neither of the parties has testified yet. This is just opening day. I mean, there have been a couple of digs at each other. I would say it was kind of an establishment of tone.
I'm looking at the Major League standings here on my computer in the studio. The Dodgers are 6.5 back of San Diego in the National League West. what does Major League Baseball have to say about this whole thing?
I think Major League Baseball is biding its time and waiting to see what the court decides. They always have to sign off on who the owners of the teams are, so they'll be very concerned if either owner decides they want to either get more investors or sell to somebody else.
Manny Ramirez, the Dodgers' big slugger, is going to Chicago.
Right.
The team is not doing real well. What are the odds of Ned Colletti, the general manager, being able to spend money on this team while the ownership is tied up in what could be a really long court fight?
Well, the Dodgers have always maintained that the pot of money that they use to buy players and spend on the team is different from the pot of money that Frank is using to finance his lawyers.
It is worth pointing out, though, isn't it, that the McCourts between them have engineered things in the Dodgers' financial structure to be able to take a huge amount of cash out of this team.
They have. They have used the Dodgers to back an enormous number of loans, and they're highly leveraged people.
What's the best possible outcome for the team out of this whole thing?
I think the best possible outcome for the team is to have owners, one or more, who are really devoted to the team and want to spend money to get top-tier players. Both McCourts have claim to be truly in love with baseball and in love with the Dodgers, just not in love with each other. And so I guess we'll have to see what happens at the end of the trial.
Dodgers against Philadelphia tonight, if you're paying attention to the scoreboard. Carla Hall from the Los Angeles Times covering the McCourt trial in downtown Los Angeles. Carla, thanks a lot.
Oh, my pleasure.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, marking the sad decline of a once proud bookselling company. Borders is still the second largest bookstore chain in the country, but it's getting smaller. Sales have been down 9 straight quarters. The rise of e-books means fewer people are buying actual books, which means Borders needs to find something else to do with its unused floor space. So it's going to sell teddy bears. Seriously, those Build-A-Bear bears that you see in malls sometimes where kids build their own bears? That's what they're going to do. If anybody sees the business connection that I'm missing, bears in a bookstore, drop me a line. Letters@marketplace.org is the email. Full disclosure, by the way, I worked at Borders briefly in the pre-bear era. And on that note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. No bears here. Today, the Dow dropped 140 points, 1.3%. The NASDAQ unloaded 33 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 took off 15 points, just under 1.5%. Our producers include Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, well, I'm just going to let this piece of tape speak for itself.
We've been outfoxed in capitalism by our friends, the communists.
China, the global economy, and how we want what they've got. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.